Great to have you with us here on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here, and I'm really pleased to have UW Arboretum Director Karen Oberhauser with us, because she is here to talk with you and with me about monarch butterflies. And maybe you already know this, but they have a pretty fascinating life cycle that's really important to us. So we'll talk about monarch butterflies with her today, and certainly want you to join in with your conversation, with your questions and comments. The number to call is 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at ideas@wpr.org. And Karen Oberhauser, welcome. Thanks for taking time to be with us today.
Thanks, Larry. It's great to be here.
How'd you get interested in monarch butterflies, by the way?
Well, you know, like a lot of people, I raised a few monarchs as a kid, so I have memories of raising them when I was a child, but I actually started studying them when I started graduate school and wanted to study a butterfly that was relatively easy to rear in captivity, that people would be interested in. So I picked monarchs, and it's been a great ride for the last 30 some odd years.
And now you're at the UW Arboretum, and the monarchs come there for sure.
We definitely have a lot of monarchs. Lots of milkweed, lots of flowers for the adults, so it's a great place for monarchs.
Well, they are getting ready for a big journey north, if I'm not mistaken, although I hope it's not in the next week or so. But their annual cycle, I think, is really fascinating. Talk about that annual cycle.
Sure. So let's start with the monarchs that people were probably seeing in their yards or other places that they went last fall. So if you saw a monarch in September, say in Wisconsin last year, that monarch was heading to Mexico, and it had a long, long journey. That trip probably took it about 2.5 months. It probably got to Mexico, to the overwintering sites, which are in central Mexico, starting kind of early November and then continuing through the month of November. And those butterflies that you saw in Wisconsin have been hanging out in Mexico since then, and they're just starting to leave. In fact, I'm getting reports right now from friends who are down there that there's actually some pretty big movement out of the overwintering sites in Mexico right now. I'm hoping a lot of them stay, because I'm actually going down there in a few days to see them. But those butterflies that are leaving now, that'll hopefully hold on for me until I get there, will start moving back kind of the early to middle of March. And those very same butterflies that you saw in your yard last year will travel north through the northern part of Mexico into Texas, and they will cover basically the southeastern quarter of the United States. And as they're moving into this area, they'll be laying eggs. And that generation, the generation that overwintered, makes it maybe as far as the middle of the country. And then it's their offspring that continue the flight north back into the northern breeding range. So if you see a butterfly in your yard, probably, yeah, not for a couple months, but we should start seeing them mid to late May. And those butterflies will be the offspring of the generation that left last year. And then we have two or three generations that don't migrate. And then the last generation of the year, starting in kind of the middle of August, anybody who emerges as a butterfly in the middle of August or later will start that cycle, that migratory cycle again. So it's a really fascinating and really amazing cycle, because when you think of it, the butterflies that migrate every year are several generations separated from the last ones that made the journey.
Wow. And so that first group that stops and lays its eggs, how long does it live beyond that?
Yeah, so that's a great question. The ones that are laying eggs, the ones that overwinter, will live 8 to 9 months. And they basically then don't reproduce. They don't lay any eggs until the spring. And they'll live for about a month and just keep laying eggs and mating during that time. So that's why they don't make it further. Their life is over before they get all the way back.
Craig in Wausau has a question or comment. Craig, let's go there to you. Thank you for calling.
Hello. Thank you. Hey, I'm wondering, I pick them, the caterpillars, out of the ditch, and then I have a little box of them I made to put them in so they hatch out as, you know, chrysalises. And I'm wondering how, you know, I had this last fall, as it starts to get colder, I'm thinking that it's, you know, it's going to be questionable whether they're going to hatch in time to release them, and some didn't. Is there anything other, I mean, it's just the, how the weather kind of is, or?
Yeah, that's a great question, Craig. If you collected them outside, it's part of their natural cycle. So you can bring them inside. If you do rear them inside, they'll be emerging about the time that they would have emerged if they had been outside. So that, you know, the timing is kind of based on when they were laid as eggs. They can fly. If it's above about 60 degrees, they can thermoregulate and warm up the muscles enough that they can fly if it's 60 degrees. And actually, if it's really sunny outside, they can fly if it's as cold as 50 degrees. The big thing, so, you know, we definitely get a lot of warm temperatures late in the season. The big thing that's important for them in order to have a successful migration south is access to nectaring plants. So if one gets released or emerges in the wild after we've had heavy freezes that kill all the flowers, then they're going to have a tougher journey. But basically, they can fly when it's still pretty cool. I've seen them emerging and flying as late as late September, early October.
All right. There we go. Thank you so much for calling, Craig. Appreciate your call. Do they live anywhere else? I mean, we're talking Mexico to the United States. Do they live anywhere in other parts of the world?
Sure. So monarchs evolved in the Americas. They're a New World butterfly. All their relatives are here. Their close relatives are here. But they have spread throughout many parts of the world, which is interesting. We don't know exactly how they got to other places, but there are well-established populations of monarchs in Hawaii, Australia, New Zealand. There are fairly large populations in southern Portugal and Spain throughout the Caribbean. So monarchs have probably been spread by people into these places, but again, we don't have recordings of that. But the biggest populations of monarchs are in the Americas, and the biggest one here is what we call the eastern migratory population, and those are butterflies that are east of the Rocky Mountains that migrate to Mexico. There's another population west of the Rocky Mountains that migrates to sites along the coast of California, and some monarchs in northern South America and through Central America, but we have the most of them. Our population here is the biggest in the world.
All right.
Biggest and best.
Adam in Deerfield, let's go to you now. Hi, Adam.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I just had a question in regards to habitat loss. I see the larger propensity of milkweed kind of along roadsides. And in my area, as well as many others, just seems like the highway department just keeps mowing further and further back, right up to crop edges, which I've never really understood the rationale for that. If there's gravel already there and, you know, a little bit of grass, but going so far deep, and it just seems like, you know, my understanding is that there is a pretty substantial habitat loss already, and that's one of the reasons for some of the decline of bees and butterflies. So is there any efforts that are being made towards educating the highway departments or somewhere within the state to try to preserve some of these roadways so that there is habitat there?
Yeah, that's a great question, Adam. Thanks for talking about roadsides. As you mentioned, roadsides are a really important habitat for monarchs and other insects. In a lot of areas, basically, roadsides are the only habitat that's left. So they're important, but you're right that roadsides and the habitat around them are often managed in ways that aren't really conducive to promoting habitat for wildlife. So I want to mention a resource that you can use to share with the whatever government entity is in charge of mowing the roadsides that you see. The Monarch Joint Venture, which is a collaborative effort of many partner organizations, has put together some information sheets about many aspects of monarch conservation. These are all available online. And one of the things that we've done is put together kind of a timeline for mowing. So if a roadside needs to be mowed in different places in the United States, what is the best timing that would have the least impact on monarchs? So mowing can be timed to minimize impacts on monarchs. Of course, you need to think about all the other organisms that are using the roadsides as well, and also think about the reasons that roadsides are managed for safety and erosion control. So there are often a lot of compromises in terms of managing roadsides, but we found through the Monarch Joint Venture and other organizations is that often departments of transportation, whether it's the federal, state, county, or township level, are usually willing to work with us on the timing and timing of mowing and other roadside management practices.
So there is some help. And where would he find that information?
Yeah, so the Monarch Joint Venture, the website is monarchjointventure.org, and there's a section there called Resources, and this is one of our information sheets that you can access and print as many as you want off for free. If you need a lot of them, you can contact the Monarch Joint Venture and get them mailed to you.
All right, there you go. Adam, thank you so much for calling. Let's take a call from Doug in Trevor next. Hi, Doug.
Hi. Hey, my question is, are the monarchs the only ones who do that as far as butterflies? You know, the migration and the multi-generation thing. Are they the only ones?
So great question, Doug. And monarchs, we've studied monarchs more than other butterflies, so we know a lot more about them in terms of the migration. But there are definitely other butterflies that migrate. So a good example are painted ladies, red admirals that you see. Most of the butterflies that you see around here are alive and well out there right now, even though it's unseasonably cold. They're either eggs or caterpillars or pupae or adults surviving the winter. But there are other species that migrate, and we don't really understand as much about the details of their migration. We know that there are no other butterflies that have the almost bird-like migration that monarchs have, where they go to very regular spots, come back from those in ways that we understand. But we do know, for example, red admirals move out of here in the fall, go somewhere south. We don't know exactly where the ones that come back here in the spring come from, but definitely other butterflies do migrate.
All right. Thank you, Doug, for calling. Appreciate your call. Do we know the system they use to find that spot in Mexico? In terms of direction?
Yeah, so that's always a question that I love to answer, because it illustrates the fact that we as scientists don't know everything. And I love it that there are still some unanswered questions out there in the world that, you know, if you're listening to this and you're a budding scientist, there's still some things that you can answer. What we do know about monarchs is how they know which way is south. So they actually have a little clock in their body, so they know what time it is, and they sense the position of the sun. So if they want to go south and it's morning, they should keep the sun on their left. And if it's afternoon, they should keep the sun on their right. And people have done some really elegant experiments to document that. But if you are somewhere in the northern tier states of the United States and you want to get to this exact place in Mexico, it's not enough for you to know just which way is south. You kind of need a map in your head, too. And that's what we don't understand. We understand they have this compass and they have a clock, but we don't understand the mechanisms of the map. So that's something that somebody really brilliant is going to have to figure out someday.
All right. Karen Oberhauser, our guest today. This is a lot of fun. She is director of the UW Arboretum in Madison. Talking with her today about monarch butterflies. You can join in, too. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234, or email us at ideas@wpr.org. I'm Larry Mueller. Jane Rotunda, our producer today. Dave Potratz, our engineer. You're listening to the Ideas Network. We're talking about monarch butterflies on the program today. I'm Larry Mueller. My guest, Karen Oberhauser, director of the UW Arboretum. Great to have her back. She has studied monarchs her whole, her whole professional career, and knows an awful lot, as you're learning, as you listen to her. Richard in Milwaukee has a question, so let's go there. Hi, Richard.
Yeah, hi, Larry and Karen. I have a question later, but mostly it's a comment. When I was studying in Mexico years ago, I saw the monarchs come through Monterrey, and then a week or two later, I was near Guadalajara at Lake Chapala, which is a pretty big lake, coming from the north, and they hit Lake Chapala. And it seemed like they were fluttering around randomly, like, dare they cross the lake, or which way should they go around it? And maybe Karen would have some comment about that, what they end up doing.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah, that's a really interesting feature of their migratory behavior, Richard. So we know that monarchs do sometimes fly over big bodies of water. And one of the coolest pieces of evidence for this is the fact that people working on oil rigs in the Gulf of Mexico sometimes see monarchs, or people that are in boats over the Gulf of Mexico. So they do get way out, far, far away from land bodies. We don't know if they've done that on purpose, or if they've gotten blown off course, because monarchs don't migrate at nighttime, and if they get over a big body of water, there's a chance that it's going to get dark before they'll find land to rest for the night on. So it could be, I mean, the monarch only weighs as much as a paperclip, so it could easily get blown off course into bodies of water. The other really interesting thing about their fall migratory behavior is there are a lot of places where they migrate and they go onto peninsulas. So we see along the Great Lakes, monarchs coming out of Canada will kind of get piled up at the ends of peninsulas. We see that at places along the eastern coast of the United States as well. And they'll actually stay in these areas for a long time, kind of wondering probably what they should do. And then when the wind is right, they'll leave. So we don't know exactly kind of what decisions they're making as they're getting ready to start off. That's another feature of their fall migratory behavior that we don't really understand. I do know, I've never seen this myself, but I've talked to friends who have seen lots of dead monarchs along the shoreline of Lake Michigan, butterflies near Milwaukee and north of there that have probably been crossing Lake Michigan, have fallen into the water, and they wash up on the shore. So we do have evidence that crossing big bodies of water is not always the smartest thing for them to do.
Not always the best thing to do. Richard, thank you so much. Appreciate it. Michael in Appleton, your turn. Hi, Michael.
Hi. My question sort of builds off the previous question. He and I must have been on the same bus or something. Because about 30 years ago, I was kicking around Mexico and traveled about the same route that he was traveling. But I didn't stop off to see the monarchs and so forth. And so my question to update that, how accessible to tourist travel are the monarchs? How safe is it to travel in that part of the country these days?
Mm-hmm. Great questions. I've never felt unsafe. I've gone to the monarch overwintering sites most years for the past 20 plus years. I've never felt unsafe there. It is in an area where there are some dangers, but tourists are usually really not very vulnerable. So just a plug for that. How accessible? There are a lot of people that visit the sites. Most of the tourists there are from Mexico, but there are certainly tourists who come from other countries as well. And because it's relatively easy and cheap to get to a city near the overwintering sites, either in the state of Mexico or the state of Michoacán, and just ask at a hotel and they'll find you someone that can take you to the wintering sites. There are also tours that you can find online, but it's not that hard to just go there on your own.
There you go, Michael. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. Jeff in Milwaukee wondered, by the way, he's going to be traveling to Santa Barbara in 2 weeks. Can he expect to see monarchs there in a couple of weeks?
Well, unfortunately, the monarch population, I said earlier, we have an eastern and a western population in the United States. The monarch population in the western United States is at its lowest point ever. We are really worried about that population. It seems to be just crashing. We don't know exactly why that's happening, but this year there are not that many monarchs at the overwintering sites in Santa Barbara or other places where they winter there. There are a few, but places that used to have thousands have tens this year.
Boy.
So it's not the greatest year for seeing them there. They also leave earlier than the monarchs leave the Mexican overwintering site. So just because there are so few this year, the exodus of them is not quite as noticeable. But they probably, if you're not going for 2 weeks, you probably won't see very many, unfortunately.
Well, let's look at the eastern monarchs then in terms of numbers, declining numbers. I saw a lot of monarchs last summer right here, just personally, but that doesn't say anything.
No, that actually does say something, Larry. You and lots of other people saw lots of monarchs last year. So last year was a great year for monarchs. The stars just aligned for them. We had perfect weather during their spring migration. The drought in Texas and the southern United States broke. So there were a lot of great conditioned milkweed plants and nectar plants for that first generation starting off. They came up here. We had not too hot, not too cold, not too dry weather up here. So it was a good year for monarchs. We think that they pretty much reached their capacity for the amount of habitat that's available for them. So if you saw a lot of monarchs last year, you're not alone. So we'll hope that that continues.
Yeah, we don't know, of course, weather and all that.
Right. So the thing is that the monarch population fluctuates a lot from year to year. So you can kind of imagine a messy EKG with the numbers going up and down. There has been, over the past 20 years, a very significant downward trend. But some years go up and some years go down. So, we need plenty of habitat for them so that they can reach their population potential in a good year like last year was. But definitely, they're not out of the woods yet.
Wayne in Appleton has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, Wayne. Thank you for calling.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call. My question is, first of all, I have three different varieties of milkweed in my yard, and one of which is the traditional milkweed that seems the broadleaf that the monarchs just prefer. And the problem that I have is keeping the caterpillars once they, they hatch and they're young, keeping them alive. And the problem that I have is aphids like to grow on the new leaves, and then the ants protect, in a symbiotic relationship, they protect the aphids. And my assumption is the ants are killing or eating the small larvae. There could be other, predators, such as wasps and stuff, taking them off. But I'm thinking the ants are my problem. What can I do other than putting my plants into a net or a screening? That can prevent the ants. What can I do to stop the ants and the aphids from growing but not kill the caterpillars?
Well, first of all, Wayne, thanks so much for growing milkweed in your yard. That's great. And I would imagine you probably have other plants as well that are helping monarchs and other insects. So thanks a lot for doing that. That's a complicated question. If you look at, we have a lot of data from studies that my lab has conducted and also data from citizen scientists. We know that about 90%, actually about 97%, if you measure all the way to the adult stage, 97% of monarchs that get laid as an egg never get to be an adult. So that is high mortality, but when you consider that against the fact that a female monarch can lay 400 to 500 even more eggs, that's okay. She's, if conditions are right, she's going to replace herself. All those predators are part of a natural, amazing web of life out there, and they need to live too. But if you like monarchs, it's kind of hard to watch this happen, I understand. So there really isn't anything you can do to control other predators, most of which are insects, that won't hurt monarchs as well. So one way to answer your question is just say, you'll just have to kind of live with that. If you have the invasive aphid, kind of the bright colored aphid that's bright orange yellow that looks kind of like a school bus color. That is not a native aphid. It tends to have outbreaks, which a lot of non-native species do, and it's not really that well tended by ants. And those aphids can draw in, they can draw in predators, things that would come to eat them. Or if it's native species of aphids, you're going to have ants coming, and you're right. Ants are predators. There are a lot of other predators as well. So, what I used to do if I got the invasive aphids is I would actually pull them off with my hand off of the plants to kind of lessen their density on the plants. Mm-hmm. You can, one of the earlier callers said, if you're interested in raising a few in your house, that's a way to keep them away from predators. That's going to help those individual butterflies. It won't have a big effect on the population as a whole. But maybe just kind of getting interested in those predators that are out there. There are some cool, you mentioned wasps. There are a lot of true bugs that eat monarchs, some beetles, spiders, mites. There are a lot of things that eat little monarch eggs and caterpillars. But again, they're kind of part of the whole system.
There you go, Wayne. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. And let's turn to Gary in Mercer next.
Hi.
Hi, Gary.
We had heard about the declining monarch butterfly population, but my wife and I had the privilege of attending the overwintering grounds in Mexico just this last Wednesday. And my expectations were not real high before we arrived there, but I was amazed at the amount of butterflies at this site. And the guide that we had actually told us that they had started leaving the week before and that there were many more there. But it was just amazing to see. It reminded me like a swarm of bees. They stay on the evergreens in the evenings and sleep, and then as the sun comes up and it warms up, they start leaving those branches. And it's just like an explosion of a swarm of bees. It's just amazing. You just can't hardly describe it.
Lucky you, Gary, and lucky you, Karen. You've seen it too.
Yeah, it is amazing. I would agree with you, Gary, that it is for me just one of the most amazing things to experience, because it's something you sense with all of your senses, your nose and your ears and your eyes. Touch, because they're landing on you. So it is a really incredible phenomenon. For me, it's a little bit like snorkeling in a coral reef, because you have, in three dimensions, you have monarchs flying around you. So it is one of the true wonders of the natural world. I agree, and that's great that you got to experience it.
Thank you, Gary. We have a young listener from Superior, Mackenzie. Let's go to Mackenzie. Hi, thank you for calling.
Hi.
Hi there. What can you tell us today?
That I just came to say, that I raise monarch butterflies in Superior.
Oh, you did?
Wow, that's so great, Mackenzie, that you raise monarchs. And I'm sure you're learning so much when you're raising those monarchs and taking care of them. And hopefully you got to let some of them go back into the wild. So raising a monarch is just an incredibly amazing thing to do. So watching it change from a caterpillar into a chrysalis and watching the butterfly come out, I'm so glad that you got to experience that. And thank you for sharing.
Thank you, Mackenzie. Appreciate your call very much. Oh, it's nice. You know, somebody, just to turn it around the other way, somebody wondered if we're raising monarchs, that this is not the real life kind of thing. Are we creating some butterflies that may change the survivability of butterflies?
Yeah, that's a really interesting question, Larry. And It kind of is a matter of scale and a matter of your personal feelings about it. So I, as has been obvious in my answers to some of the callers, I raise monarchs. I raise a ton of moths and butterflies. I really enjoy it. It's interesting to me. I like watching it. If it's done in huge, huge numbers, and if people are doing it generation after generation and rearing the monarchs or other insects for that matter in crowded conditions, then it can cause problems. So I think there's nothing wrong with somebody bringing in a few monarchs from their yard as long as they're feeding them enough, cleaning out whatever containers they're using to raise them, and letting them go into the wild. That I don't see a problem with that. But some people would disagree with me, and smart people can disagree on things. It kind of depends on somebody's own personal preferences. I do have problems with raising large numbers of them, because that can lead to problems. It can cause selection, as you implied in your question. The butterflies can become adapted to indoor conditions, but that's not going to happen in one generation. If you take a caterpillar off your milkweed and bring it into your house, that's okay.
Jeff emailed and wondered how someone could get involved in the Arboretum's monarch butterfly activities. Jeff lives near the Arboretum. Is anything planned for the general public?
Yeah, so great question. Thanks. We obviously have a lot of habitat for monarchs, and there are a couple citizen science projects that people can be involved with at the Arboretum, one called the Monarch Larva Monitoring Project, that we look at milkweed plants at the Arboretum, check for eggs and caterpillars on the plant. And if you're interested in that, feel free to contact me, and I would be happy to set you up doing that. We also are the home of another citizen science project called Journey North, which tracks my monarchs during both their journey north in the spring and also their journey south in the fall. So finding out about that project, the monarch part of that project, and contributing to that would be great as well. We're getting really excited about citizen science in general at the Arboretum. So if you're interested in monitoring lots of things, we'll have a lot going on. And then in terms of other ways to be involved at the Arboretum, we have lots and lots of volunteers who come and help in our native plant garden and in our prairies. So if you're interested in volunteering and helping from a habitat perspective at the Arboretum, just you can easily find out about volunteering online, and we would just love to have you join us, especially if you're a neighbor.
And you have a website, of course, that people can go to learn about all that.
Right. Our website has lots and lots of information about volunteering and about citizen science, and people are just welcome to contact me as well.
And let's go to Jan in Viroqua. Jan, hello. Thank you for calling.
Hi. Good morning. I would love to get a patch of milkweed established in my garden. And in the past, I bought some seedlings from a eco org, and they were terrifyingly fragile and not cheap. So the milkweed I've got so far has just volunteered itself, but I've only got one or two plants, and I'd like to create a patch. What's the best way to get a bunch going, and what's the best variety to grow?
Great questions, Jan. So it's kind of funny, isn't it, that you can see milkweed growing between cracks in a sidewalk, and then getting it started in your garden can be kind of hard. So you can either start with seeds, you can start the seeds yourself, but you can also buy them, and sometimes they do seem really fragile at first. What I've had trouble with in my garden, both here and in Minnesota, with milkweed is rabbits. The rabbits seem to love eating milkweed, so I would recommend fencing it, at least when it's small, and keeping the rabbits out from the garden. But like you said, if you have some volunteering, that's what usually happens, is it just kind of, the common milkweed sometimes comes in on its own if there's some in your neighborhood. In terms of the species of milkweed, common milkweed is a great one. And that, you can find those seeds. I wouldn't recommend necessarily buying that one, because you can easily find it for
and
free.
And they reproduce once they get going.
Yeah, so that'll be a little aggressive in your garden or your yard, but still, it's a wonderful plant. And then there are so many species. There are dozens of, or actually more than 100 species of milkweed native to North America. We have a lot of them in Wisconsin. Other good garden plants that are fairly easy to grow are swamp milkweed or Asclepias incarnata. Butterfly weed is another great one, Asclepias tuberosa. And if you're interested in learning more about growing these and native plants in general, there's a lot you can learn at the Arboretum by coming to our native plant garden, where we've been talking about featuring our milkweeds and trying to get all of the species that are native to Wisconsin growing at the Arboretum. We don't have them all yet, but we might sometime. So, you know, just kind of getting general tips on growing native plants. We have a lot of resources at the Arboretum.
Will any of those turn up at the native plant sale that you have in the spring?
Yep. All the ones that I just mentioned are there. Poke milkweed is another interesting one, Asclepias exaltata. That is a species that grows in shade. So, you know, if you live in a neighborhood that has a lot of trees, you can try Asclepias exaltata or poke, just like poking somebody in the belly. That milkweed we will definitely have at the native plant sale. There's another one that I really like that's called whorled milkweed, Asclepias verticillata. That's a fun one to grow. The leaves on it almost look like little pine needles, but monarchs like it a lot. So having a variety of species in your yard is great, because some of them do well in some conditions, some of them are good at the end of the season, some are better at the beginning of the season, some will do better if it's a dry year, some if it's a wet year. So the diversity is good for monarchs, because if you have a lot of different species, one of them is probably going to be doing well at any given point in time.
And they will, as you say, there are different plants for different times of the year when they're needed. So we shouldn't always just think in terms of fall.
Exactly. So if we're thinking about the milkweed, they need them all through the season. So I'm always a little skeptical when people say the best kind of milkweed to grow is such and such, because some of them are better at different times of the year. And then in terms of the other plants that monarchs need, as caterpillars, they need the milkweed, but as adults, they need nectar plants. Yeah. And it's not just the milkweed that provides the nectar. So they do need flowers throughout the entire growing season. So starting in mid-May, when they get back here, and through September when they're migrating, you need to have a smorgasbord of flowering plants available to them across that whole time. And not to be a big promoter of weeds, but sometimes in the beginning of the season, the best nectar source for monarchs can even be dandelions. So maybe even leave a few of those in your yard for them.
And on that note, we'll close. But Karen, I hope you'll agree to come back and be with us again. This has been fascinating discussion. We can talk about monarchs, and we can talk about other arboretum activities as well.
Sure. Thanks a lot. Thanks for having me. It was a lot of fun. And thanks to all the people who called in with great questions.
And I'm sorry we didn't get to everyone, but that's usually what happens. Karen Oberhauser, our guest. She directs the UW Arboretum in Madison, UW-Madison Arboretum. It's always great to have someone from the Arboretum come by, and I know we'll be having other folks come by, too, to talk more about that plant sale and a whole lot of other things relating to prairies. But we're going to turn our attention from insects, and particular monarch butterflies, to ourselves. We're going to look inward a little bit. And have you ever thought much about that skeleton that carries you around? That's what we're going to talk about next with the author of a new book. It's called Skeleton Keys, The Secret Life of Bone. It's a fascinating book. I'm looking forward to talking to the author, and that's next here on the Ideas Network.